This is Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston, and you're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5 FM and 92.5 FM in good old McLean County in Bloomington Normal, 88.3 in Pontiac, 97.1 in Lincoln, covering much of central Illinois. Remember that we're brought to you by you, so your donations to us are very, very important. It is what makes our station go. And if you would like to make a donation, you can reach us at our website, CatholicSpiritRadio.com. Again, that's CatholicSpiritRadio.com. And if you go to our website, it will tell you how to make a donation, and it will tell you more about us and about our newsletter and things maybe that you can contribute to our station. So go there and you'll learn a lot about us. Also, if you want to call on the phone, you can call us at 309-807-2427. Again, that's 309-807-2427. So any help that you can give will be very greatly appreciated. Nothing is too large and nothing is too small. We're going to have a great show for you today. Last week, I mentioned that we would talk a little bit about what truth is, truth and relativism. So that's going to be the opening topic in our show. And if we can get through that, we'll talk also a little bit about the fact that the wokeism movement today is nothing new, and those kinds of ideas have always existed throughout history. And we'll go into that a little bit too. So again, we're going to have a great show for you. I'm here with my wife, Lynn, and we talked again last week about a nation of deceit, about Satan being the father of lies and a liar and a murderer from the very beginning, and no truth in him. So we will talk again about what the truth is. In the meantime, I'm going to turn this over to my wife, Lynn, and see what she has to say before we start.
I've got a lot to say, but don't know if it's things you can put on there. Anyhow, you were to talk about truth, right?
Right.
It's really, really in this country, people have died for the truth, and we're trying to deny that and everything else. I heard on TV this week there were certain groups on the liberal side were accusing those trained in the military as being nothing but killers. Well, thank God those people are there, and they died. They gave up their lives for our freedom and our ability to speak the truth. You know, people can have their opinion, and they think it's true. We should allow them the right, the freedom to speak. That's it.
Okay. And again, you're talking about the truth, and the fact is that it's interesting to consider the truth and try to understand what is the truth. We can go back to scriptural times and think about what Pontius Pilate said when he was trying to find out the facts about Jesus's life, and he was arguing and listening to the crowd and all of the different opinions and things that they were saying. And very cynically, he spat out, "What is truth?" And you can understand why he was cynical about this. He was weary with the worldly problems that he was constantly wrestling with. He was a person who was used to the political and the constant lying that goes on in politics. He was exasperated probably with trying to run a country that he had been given under Roman rule and all of the pressure that went with it. And he was very, very cynical about the idea that there was any truth at all. And it's easy to do that. It was easy to do that back then in the Roman world, in a world that was beginning to slide into decadence. And it's easy to feel that way in the world that we live in today, to try and figure out just exactly what is the truth, who knows the truth, and where, how does truth differ from opinion, and is there any such thing as truth in the first place? It's easy to lapse into relativism. So we're going to talk a little bit about that and see if we can arrive at some idea of are there eternal truths that we can arrive at and that are true for all time, everywhere, and for everything? Or is everything simply relative? And so let's talk a little bit about relativism. And it's pretty simple. I mean, just consider words such as, you know, short and long. I mean, you know, if we're, say, on a football field playing football and we have an opposition on that field and we're trying to get from one end of the field to the other to make a touchdown, it seems like it's a very long way to get 100 yards or even less than that. If we start out from the 20-yard line and we've got to get 80 yards down the field, it seems like a long, long way to go. And, of course, on the other hand, if we're simply going out for a walk, and we're limited to going 80 yards, we would consider that very, very short, and we would think that we hadn't got much of a walk in at all. Or if we were doing something fun, it would be the same thing. And the same thing is with near and far. We can think to ourselves that if our car broke down and we had to get to the nearest gas station and it was a mile away, it might seem very, very far. And on the other hand, if we were out in the desert and we were faced with walking 10 or 15 miles, and then suddenly we found out that only a mile or a mile and a half over the hill there was a water hole, we would think relative to what we thought we were going to have to do, we would be very, very lucky that the water hole was near. So, I mean, things are always relative. Big, small is the same way. We might look at a basketball or something and think that it's small. We look at a marble and we think that a basketball is big. And hard, easy is the same thing. Something seems very, very hard until we come to something that's even worse and far more difficult. If we're walking along, maybe in nice weather and we're going up a hill and we think that it's hard, and we're getting a little bit tired doing it. On the other hand, if it starts raining and the wind picks up and the path gets slippery with mud and other things, we think to ourselves, oh, if it only didn't rain, this would be so much easier. So everything is relative. Motion is relative also. Being in motion and being stopped is relative to the fact that we look at something else in relation to ourselves. As we're going along in a car, we look at the telephone pole down the road, and as it appears to be sort of coming toward us and then, you know, going away from us as we pass it, and it seems again then that we're making distance. If you've ever had the experience of being in a car that's parked, I'm sure some people have that experience. You're sitting at the wheel, your car is parked in the parking lot, you're not paying attention to a lot of things, maybe listening to the radio or looking at a book or reading something, and then you look out the window and it looks like you're moving and I've hit the brakes on the car. You think you're going, and then all of a sudden you realize it's the other car parked next to you that is pulling out and you're still standing still. So everything along those lines is relative, and it tells us where we are and what we're doing. And without that relativity, we really wouldn't be able to make judgments about things. So it becomes the same way when we talk about the physical world. When we talk about the moral world, it becomes the same way. What is good and what is bad? Again, you know, it depends on the situation. If we're, again, walking along, going up a hill, as I was saying before, and we're getting tired, we think, wow, this is not good, this is bad, I wish I was going along on an easier path. And then the wind comes up and it rains and the path gets slippery. We look back on what we just called bad and we think, wow, I wish it was like that again. It wasn't so bad after all. And so it's relative. And so you get the same situation with morality. You know, what is moral and what is evil? And Dostoevsky pointed out that without God, in effect, everything is permitted. I mean, one person's judgment that something is evil is another person's judgment that something is good. In fact, it was Thomas Aquinas, and I'm sure probably Augustine and other thinkers before Thomas Aquinas, said that the normal procedure for people is to do what is good and avoid what is evil. And of course, when you look at that, people think right away, like, well, everybody doesn't do what is good. But the point Thomas Aquinas was making is that everybody tries to do what they think is good for them and avoid what they think is bad for them. And this is the nature of human beings. For example, a person might know objectively that stealing is bad. He might concede that if everybody stole and he had something stolen from him, he wouldn't like it. And so stealing is something that usually is against the law and against the rules. And he would agree with that. And he would know that stealing is the wrong thing to do and theft is not right. Nevertheless, if he saw an opportunity to steal something, he might do that because he would judge in his case that stealing was good for him, that he owed somebody a lot of money and that he was under a lot of pressure to pay it and things were not going good in his life, and he sees an opportunity to pick up the necessary amount to pay off his debts and to get himself out of trouble. And he thinks to himself, in this case, it's good, especially if he rationalized that the person or institution he was taking it from had plenty of money and it wasn't going to hurt them any. And of course, you know, that's what people do, is they rationalize away things relatively. And so therefore, in his case, stealing was okay. And so the idea is that without God, you know, without some kind of an absolute, everything is permitted and all morality, it can be explained away as just an opinion or just as a feeling, like, you know, the boo hurrah theory, that certain things are bad, boo, and certain things are good, hurrah. And that any morality is simply the personal opinion of a particular person. You might say, well, everybody would understand and agree that thou shouldn't kill. But there could be people that would make an exception to it and think that in their case, killing someone would be a good thing. Maybe it was someone that you owed a lot of money to, and if they were died, went out of existence, your problems would go away. So it's not necessarily so that every person is going to see everything exactly the same way. And there really, in the material world that we live in, there isn't really any particular place to stand and say this is the absolute stance that we can take, and anything else is good or bad or wrong. Everything becomes personal. And we get to the point where people say, my truth is not your truth, and your truth is not my truth. And so we ask the question, is there any way to determine good or bad? Is there any way to determine moral evil from an absolute point of view? Any way to determine truth or falsehood from an absolute point of view? And we can get into a lot of ways that people have tried to do that. And a lot of those ways have problems of their own. We can get into what we would call consequentialism, for example. Someone can say, well, we can tell what's good or evil by the consequences. What are the consequences? Pleasure or pain. I mean, if we walk off a cliff, the consequences will be bad. We will, you know, get severely hurt or maybe even die. So certainly walking off a cliff would be a bad thing. But nevertheless, we see all the time that people jump off bridges and they jump off cliffs or they jump off other high places in order to kill themselves because they consider that the life that they are living is worse than the consequences, which would be death of jumping off a cliff. And so it's, again, there's that relativity. So consequential in itself isn't necessarily a means of judging good and bad. The other problem with consequentialism is, you know, when do the consequences stop? You can have consequences. Does anyone ever remember the old radio shows where they had the sort of a little skit that, you know, that's good, that's bad? You know, somebody would say, I ran my car into a tree, and then the other comedian would say, "Oh, that's bad." And the guy would say, "No, that's good. I got the car was a junker, and I got paid from the insurance company and was able to come out ahead on the car." And the guy would say, "Oh, that's good." And the guy would say, "No, that's bad, because I took the money to use it, and I bought something that caused me to have an accident where I broke my leg." And this would go on back and forth, back and forth. You know, the that's good would be turned into the that's bad, and the that's bad would turn into that's good. And so when we go by consequences, first of all, consequences are interpreted differently by everybody. And secondly, we don't know for sure always what the consequences might be. You know, the idea that if you do this, the consequences will be bad. And sometimes actually a person does that and the consequences turn out good, or a person does something that they think they are doing the right thing and the consequences turn out bad. And then those consequences cause other consequences, and this goes on and on. So trying to determine good and bad by consequentialism is not necessarily a very workable thing, and it doesn't always work. So there also is the personal outlook. Everybody interprets the consequences differently. And again, you know, when do they stop? So that's one way people try to determine laws. Politicians try to figure out what they should do. And actually, it's really, you know, not necessarily foolproof, and a lot of things can go wrong with it. And then another way of looking at the world philosophically and trying to determine what's good or bad, or what should be done or shouldn't be done, is utility. And that philosophy is called, not unsurprisingly, utilitarianism. And it's similar to consequentialism. And the idea is that utilitarians would say we ought to do what is the greatest good for the greatest number. Yeah, but the question is that what is the greatest good for the greatest number? And then who gets to decide? And we can decide democratically, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the utility will turn out good. And what about the fact that it may turn bad for, you know, some people? Do the minority have to suffer bad consequences for the utility, you know, of the majority? For example, suppose the majority of people, for some reason or another, don't like red-haired people. And there are very few red-haired people, and there are lots and lots of dark-haired people. And they say, look, if we get rid of the red-haired people, the consequences, you know, the utility of it would be such that most of the people in society would be happier. So let's get rid of the red-haired people. You can see where that's going. And so utilitarianism is not necessarily an answer either. We're going to have to stop here and take a break. We'll come back and talk about this a little bit more and see if we can get at something that actually is the truth and something that is a little bit more absolute. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
The world is broken and needs authentic leaders. The Authentic Leadership Foundation works through schools and other youth organizations to help young people build character and become their best self. The foundation will host its first annual event, Bring Out the Greatness, featuring Alexander Havard and Immaculee Ilibagiza, who have each committed themselves to bringing out the greatness in others. Your family is invited to join via live stream or in person on October 29th or 30th, broadcast live from the Jesuit Dallas Terry Center in Dallas, Texas. To register, visit AuthenticLeadershipFoundation.org.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston. We're back from our break. You're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio. We're talking a little bit about truth. Last week, we were talking about the fact that we seem to be living in an area in a time of great deceit in our nation, where there is a lot of misinformation, disinformation, and a lot of deceit going on. And we're talking about the virtue of truth. And the idea, of course, the question we have to ask about that is, you know, what is truth? And last week I said we would talk a little bit about that. So we have been talking about the various ways things are relative, and the various ways that people try to arrive at truth, and some of the problems with those things, and asking the question, are there some things that are true that we can arrive at that would be true in every age, for every person, and for all time, and maybe true even if the human race went out of existence, or maybe true even if this universe went out of existence and there were other universes that existed elsewhere. Would there be something true at all times, past, present, and future? And would there be something that was true even if human beings went out of existence? And would there be something that is true even if the universe that we live in went out of existence, but there were still other universes, as some people try to suggest? So we'll see if we can get to that. But at any rate, going on with this utilitarianism and consequentialism, there also is the idea of hedonism, that is a pleasure-pain principle. People ought to seek pleasure and avoid pain. But the question there again is that what exactly is pleasure? Everybody agrees on something, a different definition of it. So one person's pleasure might be another person's pain. And then we can take a look at our own society. There are a lot of fun things and entertainment things to do in our very, very wealthy society, our very affluent society. But is that always necessarily a good thing? Fun and enjoyment can actually degenerate, and you can degenerate virtue into vice, and that can happen. And we have some things in our society today. I think maybe people can realize, is there an overemphasis on safetyism? It's hard for me to think of another word, but people today put this huge emphasis on everything being safe. And it has actually filtered down into our young people so that they even have to be emotionally safe, protected from the slightest hurt or the slightest hint of disagreement or whatever. We have situations in which you see kids sometimes on an ordinary playground wearing helmets. Their parents want them, you know, how far can this go before the safety degenerates into sort of a totalitarian life? I mean, that, in other words, is the idea that anything that is preventable, must it be prevented? Must we somehow or another force some kind of device or behavior or whatever on people because we know if we do, we can avoid some kind of situation? I mean, do we all, you know, at some point you could live in a cage and be fed and taken care of and be perfectly safe and live your whole life there without anything being a threat to your physical being, but would that be any kind of a life that anybody would want to live? I mean, without risk and without doing things and without putting yourself in danger at times, the spice of life is lost. And so we see a lot of that going on today, too. So is that, you know, necessarily a good thing? And then it degenerates into this catastrophism. Catastrophism, I guess, is the word I want to say. In other words, does everything then become a catastrophe? I mean, not only are we looking at personal safety, but all of a sudden we start assuming that we are in charge of everything and that all kinds of crises and catastrophes are coming at us, and somehow or another we must be able to prevent them, or it's a doomsday situation. And we get this with the climate people, the idea of climate control, the idea that the climate is changing and that it's going to change in such a drastic way that by 2035, some people are saying, which is not very long from now, the whole Earth is going to, you know, die and people are going to go out of existence, that the climate will destroy everything on the Earth, and we have to focus all of our attention. Do we have to live in poverty and live in sort of a totalitarian system or authoritarianism just to avoid these catastrophes that are being thrown at us? Some of these things, for example, there was a sign in Glacier National Park they had to be taken down, I think, this year, or at least within the last year or so, that predicted that the glacier would be gone by 2021 or 2022. The glacier was melting. Well, the glacier hasn't melted. It isn't gone. It's still there. And so they're going to have to take that sign down. What do? Put another sign up that says the glacier will be gone in 2025 or another one up that in 2035? And when the Earth was filled with glaciers, when we had glaciation all over this country, or was that a good thing? I mean, the fact that we're living between glaciers and those glaciers melted off, we have a lot more farmland. Things do seem a lot better. On the other hand, if you were living back then, the fact is that you would have, if you lived long enough, you would have lived through the extinction of a lot of animals that were around in the Ice Age, mastodons and so forth that are no longer here. And if you were living back then, you could have read the melting of the glaciers as being a catastrophe. So again, the fact is that all of these means of predicting the future or deciding what's good or deciding what's bad seem to have problems with them. So is there, you know, something other than this, than seeking pleasure, avoiding pain, trying to determine good or bad by consequences, trying to determine good or bad? We can even go to life and death. There have been philosophers that tried to find some kind of philosophy in which the standard of goodness would be life and the standard of badness would be death. And you get to a point also where that's not necessarily a solid means of deciding how to live. I mean, the fact is that very quickly that idea of life and death as a standard degenerates into what kind of life? And again, the quality of life is not the same thing as life. I mean, someone can choose to die because the quality of life in their opinion is bad. So the standard of having life is a means of the good and death is a means of the bad is not necessarily true. And if you read Jonathan Swift, he talked about the Struldbrugs in his Gulliver's Travel, were people that were blessed or cursed, actually, with immortality. And it turned out to be a disaster because as they got older and older, they became more decrepit and mentally restricted and worse and worse and worse, but they could not die. And so their quality of their life degenerated in huge, you know, in greater proportion than the length of life would warrant. And so the idea of simply life as being a standard of the good didn't work out there as well. So is there anything that we could resort to on this material here in this here and now that would be something that would be absolute truth? So let's go ahead and talk about a few things that may actually be something that could be universally true, and we can go from there to try and understand if there is an absolute God that sets for us a morality that can be trusted. And the first thing we can talk about is universals. There are things that are called universals, and these things are deemed to be universally true, and a very solid case could be made for this. For example, we can talk about triangles. There are such things, of course, as particular triangles, and a triangle is a closed figure, where the angles add up to 180 degrees, and this is the definition of a triangle. And there are, you know, you can draw all kinds of triangles. You can draw triangles with the thick lines. You can draw triangles with thin lines. You can have real triangles made out of material. A triangle can be made out of wood. A triangle can be made out of iron or steel. Or a triangle can be made out of plastic or whatever you would want to make it out of. Triangles can be different color and so forth. But the thing is that what we do is abstract a universal out of there called triangularity. And triangularity is the idea that there is a three-sided figure, straight lines. Those lines are closed, and the angles add up, each angle put together, the three angles, add up to 180 degrees. And the sides are exactly straight, and the angles are exactly adding up to 180 degrees. And the triangles have to be either an isosceles triangle, an equilateral triangle, or a scalene triangle, I mean, having three different sides, you know, that are different lengths. So this is the concept of triangularity that is abstracted out of triangles. Now, the question is in the material world, can there be any such thing as a perfect triangle? And the answer, of course, is no. No matter how carefully we draw a triangle, no matter what kind of instruments that we have and how straight and perfect they are, if we magnified those instruments enough, we would see that the very atoms that they are made up of are actually moving and shaking. And no matter how hard we try to get a perfect angle and angles that would stay perfectly true, it's impossible to do so. If we just magnified them big enough so that with our naked eye, we could see that if we drew triangles with a pencil, for example, that there would be little quirks and little discrepancies, and that they wouldn't close exactly right. And no matter how careful we were with the best instruments, blow them up big enough and you would see that there are errors. And so in reality, in the real world, we cannot draw a triangle that is perfect. But nevertheless, we understand that the idea of triangularity, the idea of a perfect triangle, the idea that a perfect triangle exists having perfectly straight lines, that the lines are three, that they're closed, and that the angles add up to 180 degrees. This idea of a perfect triangle nevertheless persists and does exist. And that is called a universal, that the triangularity is a universal. And universals are truisms that exist, and they don't exist in the real world. Some people might say, does the universal exist in our mind only? In other words, it doesn't exist in the real world. Where does it exist? Well, Plato said that a triangularity, for example, a universal like triangularity, exists in a third realm. Now, he didn't say where that was at. You know, it wasn't the earth. It was a place that he called the third realm. And that's where it must exist. A Christian nation would say it exists in the mind of God, and a secularist would say that triangularity is real, not nominalist. The nominalists try to actually deny there are such things as universals, and they don't succeed. Their arguments simply fail, and they fail pretty badly, really. But the fact is that most people would agree that there are such things as universals, but some people try to point out that they only exist in the mind. But the point is there is if a triangularity only exists in the mind, what happens to triangularity when the mind goes out of existence? In other words, does triangularity go away if all human beings are dead? If all human beings would disappear tomorrow, would triangularity disappear? And the answer is, of course, we know is no. Triangularity would still exist. In other words, triangularity has to be true in every age. It has to be true for Plato. It has to be true for Aristotle. It has to be true for me and for you. It has to be true for the future. We would know that no matter how long we are, you know, going to, if someone said 100 years in 100 years from now, we will disprove triangularity, we wouldn't even have to bother arguing with them. There will be no such thing as a disproof of it. If we have three straight lines that are closed, we are going to have a triangle, and a perfect triangle will have 180 degrees. And that is a truism that exists not only when we are gone in this universe, but if you imagine that all of the whole universe that we live in went out of existence, that triangularity is still going to exist in every universe, because triangularity is inevitable if you have three straight lines that are closed. It's as simple as that. There, you don't have to go to any proof beyond that. It's just apparent that it is that way, and it doesn't depend on human beings. So where, then, does the concept of triangularity exist? Well, we know it exists in the mind, and it doesn't exist in the real world. And I shouldn't say the real world, but the material world. But it does exist in the mind. And the mind, of course, is not material. The brain may be, but the mind is not. So triangularity exists in the mind, but if it goes out of existence, if the mind goes out of existence, if the whole human race's mind goes out of existence, it still doesn't disappear. So where does it exist? And the answer to that question by people like St. Augustine or Thomas Aquinas would be that universals exist in a mind. They do not exist outside of mind. They have to exist in mind, and that mind, of course, then has to be the mind of God. It has to be the mind of a being that always exists, that never came into being, that has always existed and will continue to exist and would exist no matter how many universes there were. So that's one of the reasons we can finally come to a truth, and we'll get into a little bit more of that in the next segment. But right now we're going to have to stop here and take a break, so stay with us. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
Are you fed up with the burden and chaos of the present age? If yes, stop and think. Whom have you chosen to be governed by? Is it Christ, the King? Join fellow Catholics in the presence of Jesus Christ, Savior and Sovereign King of the Solemn High Mass, in the traditional Latin form in the Church of the Holy Rosary Shrine at LaSalle, Illinois, on Sunday, October 31st at 1 p.m. Holy Mass will be followed by procession and benediction. Refreshments follow in the shrine basement. The government shall be upon his shoulders. Bring your family and friends and enter the court of Christ the King. God bless you.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston. You're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio. We're talking about truth and relativity, and we were talking in the first part of the program about the fact that it seems like everything in this world is relative, and are there any ways that we can arrive at truths that are not relative, that are absolute and exist through all time, that would be true for every human being in every age, and would be true for us, and would be true in the future, and would be true even if human beings went out of existence, and would still be true even if the universe went out of existence and there were other universes, as some scientists proclaim that there may be, in any universe that we can imagine, these truths would have to exist. They exist by a logic that is inescapable, that they don't exist in the material world, but nevertheless they do exist, and so forth. Therefore, they have to exist in a non-material world such as mind. And since our own minds go out of existence, and these things would still exist, then there has to be a mind that is always in existence, that never goes out of existence, and this would be the mind of God. And so ultimate truth, absolute truth, exists not in the material world, but in the mind of God. And we can come to know absolute truth because there is a God, and God can then reveal truth to us. And that truth, other than the propositions and so forth that we can see with our own minds, that truth we take on faith. But that faith is justified because we can show that there is a mind that does exist, and there are truths that do exist, and those truths are not material, and therefore must exist in the mind of God. Propositions are another thing that we can are like universals that exist, and they exist regardless. They exist in our minds, but even if our minds are gone, they still exist. A mathematical proposition, for example, such as 2 + 2 = 4. This is true even if our minds are gone. Even if the human mind goes out of existence, 2 + 2 would still equal 4 in any universe. 2 + 2 = 4 for Aristotle, 2 + 2 = 4 for us, and 2 + 2 will equal 4 for people in the future. And if someone should come along and tell you that, well, someday 2 + 2 might not equal 4, it might equal 5, or it might equal 3, you can just dispense with even arguing with such a person. It's a waste of time. 2 + 2 is always going to equal 4, and there isn't any way that it cannot equal 4, and it will equal 4 in every universe there is, and it exists not in the real world. 2 + 2 = 4 is a proposition. We can have objects in the real world that we can demonstrate the proposition, but the proposition itself, the idea that we can state 2 + 2 = 4, that proposition exists. It's not just a sentence. It's actually, a statement that declares something to be true, and that something has to be true, and it exists even if our minds were gone, and the universe alone would be here, or even if that universe was gone, it would exist in any universe. 2 + 2 always have to equal 4. And so the only place that it can exist outside of our own minds would be in the mind of God. I mean, Plato, you can say, well, it must exist somewhere else. It must exist in somewhere. But the fact is that it exists as something that's non-material, something that's spiritual. It exists in something that is a mind, like our minds, because it does exist in the mind. We can't see it, smell it, touch it, or taste it, but we do know it. And so the fact that it is known, and it is a knowing by someone, we have to get that from somewhere. It doesn't exist in the real world, and so our minds have to be in touch with and similar to a more comprehensive mind, because we know without doubt that it exists past, present, future, that it's outside of time, and it's outside of space, it's outside of our whole universe, it always exists. And it's one of the proofs that there must be a godly mind that exists, and that's where truth lies. And that's what we're trying to get at, is that these propositions are always true, even if the world and the human mind is gone, because propositions, universals, and mathematical truths have to exist somewhere. They don't exist in the material world. They're always true. They don't change. And so we can be sure that there are truths that are eternal, and those truths have to exist in mind. And that mind has to be a mind that doesn't come into existence, that is not contingent on anything, that exists always and everywhere. And that is the mind of God. And that brings us to, and I hope everybody isn't getting bored here, I know it's going on, but the thing is that if we are going to have any truths that we can really stand on and a place to stand on the world, there is no way to arrive at any absolute truth in the material world itself without understanding that an absolute truth has to come from something that is not material, and something that is not contingent upon anything, and that is God. So again, what is contingency? So we'll talk about that, and then we'll see if we can come to a conclusion and end the show on that. And contingency, again, is one of the, if someone asks you that they would like to have a proof for God, contingency is probably the most definitive proof that there is a God, and probably one of the most simple ways that you can rationally show that there has to be a being, a God, that is all mind and that exists spiritually outside the realm of the material and does not ever come into existence. That is an unchanged changer. If we look at an unchanged changer, if we look at everything in the world that comes into existence, it always comes into existence through the change comes about through a force outside of itself. For example, if we took a stick and that stick changed to get it to change into ashes, for example, we put a match to it, catch the stick on fire, it burns, and then it becomes ashes. In other words, change, the stick itself cannot change itself. If it sat there and there was nothing else operating on it, no air, no water, no light, no anything, it would simply remain what it was. In order for its potential, and that is what, you know, we call the ability of the stick, it has potential to turn into ashes, but that potential has to be activated by something outside of itself. And so in order for it to change into ashes, fire has to act on it, or maybe sunlight has to act on it long enough, or maybe wind and water would have to act on it long enough for it to degenerate and decay into the ashes that it will become. The potential that it does have has to be activated by something else. And we can look at that for everything in the world, everything that comes into existence, no matter what it is, whether a leaf falls off a tree and it turns yellow, the yellow comes into existence in the leaf. It has to come into existence to be activated by something else. The wind has to knock the leaf off the tree, or something else does. The sugars and so forth have to be acted on by the sunlight in order to change their colors so that the leaf becomes a different color. And then the leaf itself has to decay into something else by, again, sunlight, wind, water, whatever. Everything in this world is contingent. That is, it can't come into existence unless something else outside of itself activates it. It needs an activator. It needs something that changes it. And we can look at everything that way. We can look at, let's say, a table. A brick is on a table, and the table is holding up the brick. Everything in that table has to be, the atoms and so forth, all have to be acted on in order for them to be hold together and be holding up that table. If any of those things were taken out of existence, the table would disappear, or the table would simply fall, the brick would fall. Everything that comes into existence is contingent upon something else. The table, the brick is being held up by the table, but the table is being held up by the atoms and so forth that make up the table. The atoms are being held together by the forces that make up the atoms. The forces that hold the atoms together are electrical impulses and other things that we can't really see, but they have to be held together. In other words, all the things in the universe are contingent upon something else. But the point is that nothing can get started. We can't, you know, we can't keep going back and back. We can't say, well, the atoms are held up. It would be like a train without an engine. We can't say that if we see a train passing, that one car is pulling another car, and then that car is pulling another car. If the cars aren't being moved by something, then the cars have no power of their own to move themselves. And it's the same thing with everything else in the universe. For them to do what they're doing, or to make the changes that they change, or to move from one place to another, in other words, any change that we see going around us has to be change that is constantly being acted upon. But that can't go forever. I mean, one thing can't act on another thing, and another thing act on it, and so forth, without an activator that is always in existence, that never changes, and that doesn't come into existence or go out of existence. It has to be an unchanged changer. And there has to be something in the world that is not contingent upon anything else. And that unchanged changer, this is what Aristotle talked about, there has to be an unchanged changer that causes the change of everything else. And since a cause cannot give the effect, and it can't give something that it doesn't have, every cause has to have the ability to give the effect that we see. So if we throw a rock through the window, the rock has to have the ability to shatter the window. If we threw a cotton ball at a window, nothing would happen. The cotton ball would simply bounce off and slide down the window, and nothing would happen. The cause has to have within it, it has to contain that which will give the other thing its effect. And without that, nothing could come into existence. And so ultimately, something has to be a prime cause that changes everything else and causes everything else to come into existence. And that prime cause cannot be something that is changeable or changes itself. In other words, a prime cause has to contain everything else. So the idea that Aristotle was getting at is there has to be what he called God. There has to be a something that comes in that causes everything else to come into existence, but doesn't have any cause to cause itself to come into existence. It has to always be in existence, and it has to contain everything that everything else has, because it can't give what it doesn't have. So something that would be God would contain everything. You could ask, for example, can God move? Can an unchanged changer move? And the answer would be no. An unchanged changer cannot move because an unchanged changer can't change. It contains all change. An unchanged changer can't move because an unchanged changer is already there. Does an unchanged change, can an unchanged change have a particular color? And the answer is no, because an unchanged changer is color itself. An unchanged changer gives color to everything else. Can an unchanged changer be material? Could it be some kind of gas, or could it be, you know, an original atom? No. Because any of those kind of material things move from one place to another. And to move from one place to another is to change. And an unchanged changer can't change. If it could change, something else would have to change it. Something else would have to move it from one place to another. Even a human being can move from one place to another. But the fact is, it has to have a part of its body that moves while another part of its body stands still, or it would not be able to move at all. In other words, it has to have a mover. When we walk, for example, one leg is a mover and the other leg is being moved. And then we just switch. The next leg then is the mover and the other leg is being moved. In other words, everything that changes, comes into existence, goes out of existence or changes, has to have a changer outside of itself. And so an unchanged changer can't have anything outside of itself. Could there be more than one unchanged changer? And the answer would be no. Because how would you tell if an unchanged changer contains everything because it has to give everything what it has, then an unchanged changer, in order for there to be two unchanged changers, one would have to lack something or have something that the other doesn't, and that would mean that one of them would lack something. If one was red, the other one would lack red. And so, therefore, that would not possibly be the unchanged changer, because it would lack something and it would have to get it from something else. So a prime changer has to be one thing. So God, as Aristotle came to the conclusion, is one. There can't be two, because an unchanged changer simply has to have everything. And if two so-called two unchanged changers had everything, they would simply be one. They would simply be everything, and everything is one, and one is everything. So you can't get away from that either. So there is, if we look at the world around us, the contingency argument shows us that the world itself, that the universe itself, or any number of universes that come into existence have to come into existence by something else. And that is a truth that we can arrive at, that through our minds. And the reason our minds can arrive at that, that has to be a truth that is true regardless of what age we live in, whether it's the past, the present, or the future. That has to be true in any universe that's in existence, because a universe itself couldn't come into existence unless there was an unchanged changer that could bring it into existence. Because anything that is material in the material world always is contingent upon something else. And you finally, you have to get to the prime something else, and the prime something else cannot be subject to change, cannot come into existence or go out of existence. It has to always have been in existence. There isn't anything that could have created God. God is the unchanged changer that changes everything. We can arrive at that truth, and we know then that there is such a thing as absolute truth, and that the things in our minds, such as universals, propositions, and mathematical truisms, are a product of that unchanged changer. Our mind has to be in contact with the mind of God, and through that, we can arrive at truth. So I sort of took a long path around the barn, I do understand. But the fact is that it's necessary to show that the people that tell you that there is no such thing as truth are wrong. And all truth then proceeds from God. And the abandonment of God leads into what God has declared to us through Jesus Christ himself, who is the God incarnate, when he said, Satan is a liar. He was a liar from the beginning. There is no truth in him. He is the opposite of truth. And the fact is that the people that pretend that everything is relative simply are wrong, and they can be shown to be wrong in a logical fashion. It doesn't have to depend on the Bible or anything else. We can arrive at that truth with our own minds and know that our minds are in contact with the mind of God. So we're going to stop there, and we'll come back next week, and we'll talk about some other things. But I hope that is something that illustrates how we can arrive at things that are true, and that there is such a thing as truth, and that without God, truth disappears, and the human mind becomes confused and dark, and that's exactly what Satan does, because he can't help himself in the sense that Satan is the opposite of truth. There is no truth in him. He is a liar and a murderer from the beginning. So we'll stop there, say our prayer. Saint Michael the Archangel, defend us in battle. Be our protection against the wickedness and snares of the devil. May God rebuke him, we humbly pray. And do thou, Prince of the heavenly host, by the power of God, thrust into hell Satan and all evil spirits who wander through the world for the ruin of souls. Amen.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5. If you'd like to contact Bob, email bob@catholicspiritradio.com. Again, that's bob@catholicspiritradio.com. Catholic Spirit Radio relies on your support to bring programming like this and EWTN to Central Illinois 24 hours a day. Please help keep Catholic Spirit Radio on the air with your generous support. Donate online at catholicspiritradio.com. Or send a donation to Catholic Spirit Radio, 108 Boykins Place, Normal, Illinois, 61761. That's Catholic Spirit Radio, 108 Boykins Place, Normal, Illinois, 61761. Catholic Spirit Radio is a 501c3, and all donations are tax deductible. Thank you for your support of Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.